Welcome back to TRP.
Many years ago, I wrote a book called The Chocolate Flame Venus. I'd like to read a couple of excerpts from this book. I'll start with the prologue. One would need to have lived in the townsland of Gertin to truly appreciate the concept of a dreary September afternoon. Lost deep within the sap-green hills on the southwest coast of Ireland, and dissected by the crumbling stone walls and winding boreens skirting the barren patchwork fields, Sheepshead Peninsula lay forgotten, shrouded in the mists of time, buried beneath the fathomless weight of antiquity and the ominous dark clouds rolling in from a tortured grey-green sea. Isolated in the extreme, even the horrors of a war-torn Europe seemed to have passed it by. I suppose what I was trying to do when I wrote this book was to make people aware of our shameful past, not just the church and state, who were undoubtedly bedfellows. You see, the shame of pregnancy was too much to bear for Catholic-ridden families who couldn't conceal their daughter's bumps, but could remain tight-lipped as to how their daughter found herself in her harrowing predicament. Incest was rampant in rural Ireland, and yet it was the young, innocent girls, victims of rape, who suffered the shame, the rejection, the horror of the institutions, while mothers and fathers sat tight-lipped behind their lace curtains, peeping out, safe in the knowledge that their part in the deed would never come to light. I suppose Chapter 1 of the book is an insight into those times. Chapter 1, West Cork, Ireland, 1944. Kitty entered the kitchen, her face flushed, her school bag sagging on her back. Blackie, her collie, jumped up to greet her, momentarily knocking her off balance. She patted him on the head. "Who's a good boy?" she asked breathlessly. The dog yelped and licked her face. She squirmed. "Oh, Blackie, you're disgusting." Grabbing his paws, she lowered them to the ground and pointed to an old cardboard box nestled in the corner. "Into bed." The dog reluctantly shied away. Kitty brushed down her blue school uniform, pulled on the elastic garters and straightened her wayward socks. Standing by the old pine table, she slipped the bag from her shoulder and dropped it to the flagstone floor. Though the kitchen was small and cramped, it was the heart of the cottage. Glossy grey paint covered the walls, peeling near the damp, yellow-stained ceiling. An old pine dresser containing a selection of hot cups and plates stood by the door leading to the hall. To the left of it, a holy water font with a chipped figure of the Virgin Mary hung from a blue dado rail. Dull lace curtains dangled limply across the window frame in front of the Belfast sink. The constant drip of a solitary brass tap seemed to count away the seconds and minutes with monotonous regularity. Behind her, a large black kettle simmered quietly on top of a small agar cooker, her mother's pride and joy. She loved to shine the two copper pipes feeding from it, like a captain might polish the brass on his yacht. But in the few short days since her departure, the copper had begun to tarnish. An assortment of woolen vests aired on the makeshift line, sagging like a crescent moon above the range. A fly strip, brown and tacky, bespattered with countless flies, hung by a brass thumbtack from the rafter in the ceiling. Kitty, a pleasant-looking 14-year-old with black curls, full face and sparkling brown eyes, was sturdy, slightly plump and full-breasted for her tender years. Her cheeks glowed red from her exertions, and she tried cooling them with the back of her hand. Every day she cycled to and from school, irrespective of the weather. Though the school building was cramped, run down and damp, Kitty loved it and was one of the brightest in her class. To her, it was a social excursion, a chance to be with girls of her own age. Outside school hours, she had little chance to spend time with them. An open newspaper, a half-empty mug of tea and an overflowing ashtray lay on top of the crumb-strewn table. She cupped her hands and wiped the scraps away. "Men," she muttered as she glanced at the headlines. "Germany unleashes V1 bomb on London. Hundreds killed." Such articles no longer frightened her. She had become immune to the horrors of conflict. To Kitty, it was no different than reading the pages of a war novel. She folded the paper and put it to one side. Opening her school satchel, she grabbed some books, placed them on the table, sat down and began to do her homework. Blackie eyed her from his cardboard box, his head resting on his outstretched paws. The sound of the latch lifting and the distinctive grating of the front door distracted her momentarily. Her father had promised he would fix it, yet despite her mother's constant reminders and his genuine intentions, nothing had ever been done. Blackie lifted his head as the hall began to fill with light. A dark shadow fell across the grey coats hanging behind the door, and Kitty heard the familiar sound of hobnailed boots. A burly figure filled the frame of the kitchen door. "Hello, Bill," she said softly.
"You're back, I see,"
he said in a slurred voice. Blackie lowered his head. Bill was in his late 30s, tall and powerfully built, some 8 years younger than Kitty's father. He reminded her of a pirate with his stubble chin, high cheekbones, unkempt hair and weather-beaten face. A black leather belt pinched his shabby trousers at the waist. He wore an old threadbare flannel shirt with rolled-up sleeves and missing buttons, exposing his brown muscular arms and chest. In his hand, he held a bottle. It looked like water, but Kitty knew better. It was one of her father's bottles of potsheen. She hated when he drank. He raised the bottle to his mouth and took a swig. With glazed eyes, he looked her up and down for some moments before muttering,
"Stick on the supper like a good girl. I'm starving, and wash those dirty dishes while you're at it."
He turned and left. The door grated, the latch fell shut, and the little hall darkened once more. She could tell by the way he swayed that he'd been drinking heavily and yearned for her mother and father's return. She felt nervous when he drank. His personality changed, and he often became aggressive. She knew if her father was home now, there was no way he would be drinking like that. Pouring hot water from the kettle, she began to wash the dishes piled in the kitchen sink. Through the net curtains, she could vaguely see him outside, chopping logs for the approaching winter. She watched him struggle for balance as he raised the heavy axe awkwardly above his head, shuddering as he sent it crashing down with thunderous force, splitting the timber logs as if they were matchsticks. Despite her misgivings, she genuinely feared for his safety. Finally, he cast the axe aside, grabbed the bottle and returned to the house. Kitty busied herself with the dishes as he entered. He stood momentarily, swaying in the doorway, steadying himself with his free hand. He did not speak. She could feel his eyes upon her, but dared not turn round. He stumbled into the kitchen and stood behind her. She could feel his laboured breath upon her hair. "You must be tired. Supper will be ready soon," she said, avoiding eye contact.
"Is that what you think?" he mumbled.
"It's heavy work," she said, placing a plate on the draining board.
"I'll show you who's tired."
He plunked the bottle onto the table. Kitty jumped with fright. Before she had time to react, he grabbed her skirt and lifted it above her waist, exposing her faded blue knickers, her white muscular thighs and the firm round cheeks of her bottom. She struggled to break free, but his strong hands began groping her and tugging at her underclothes.
"Stop," she screamed. "I'll tell Daddy on you."
He wasn't listening. Kitty, in desperation, splashed a mug of soapy water into his face. He let go, rubbing his stinging eyes.
"You bloody bitch," he yelled.
Running to her bedroom, she locked the door, hurriedly jamming a chair beneath the handle before huddling in a corner in a fetal position beside her unmade bed. The room was small and cluttered. Cardboard boxes packed with clothes lay stacked against the walls. A few of her favourite dolls rested on the window ledge. Despite its shortcomings, she loved her room. It was her sanctuary, the place she went when she needed to be alone.
"Kitty, I know you're in there."
He knocked gently on the door, his voice now soft and warm.
"I'm sorry, Kitty. Please, let me in. I just want to talk, that's all."
Frightened, she did not reply.
"Let me in," he roared. "If you don't, I'll break the bloody door down."
glancing at the picture of the Sacred Heart above her bed, she prayed he would go away. An almighty crash of a boot against the door told her he had not. The timbers split, the chair creaked beneath the door handle. Kitty trembled. Blackie began to bark. Bill's voice was animated now, full of anger and venom.
Let me in, you little whore!
Once more, he kicked out. This time, the timbers gave way to the force of his boot crashing against them. Splinters fell to the floor. Kitty picked herself up, ran to the window and hastily opened it. The door handle rattled violently.
I'm warning you. Let me in. You'll be sorry.
Lifting the net curtains, she hurriedly climbed out the window, grazing her knee and knocking her dolls in the process as she made good her escape. With a crash, the bedroom door flew open. The chair broke into several pieces and fell to the floor. Blackie barked excitedly. Bill stepped into the bedroom.
I warned you,
he said in a slurred voice. Blackie ran to the window. Only then did Bill realize Kitty was no longer in the room.
Bloody bitch!
Turning, he stumbled over the broken chair and out through the shattered door, swaying wildly as he followed the dog into the yard. Chickens cackled, flapping wings and scattering in all directions as he approached. The cockerel raised his chest, crowing defiantly, before it, too, took flight. He stood swaying in the middle of the yard, gasping for breath, listening for a telltale sound.
Kitty, where are you? I just want to talk.
Blackie crossed the yard, sniffing the ground.
Good boy, Blackie. Go fetch.
The dog headed off in the direction of a disused outhouse before disappearing behind an upright cart. Behind it, Kitty sat sobbing, holding her head in despair. The dog came and licked her face. Please go away, Blackie, she whimpered as she tried to shove the dog from her. It was too late.
Well, there you are, he said in a softer voice.
He grasped the shafts of the cart to steady himself. Slowly, he stepped forward, stooping down and patting the dog on the head.
You're a great boy, Blackie, do you know that?
The dog wagged his tail and licked his hand. He spoke quietly to Kitty as he approached her.
What's the matter? Why the tears?
She did not respond.
Let's have a little chat, you and me. What do you say?
Again, she ignored him. He slid awkwardly down the crumbling whitewashed walls till he landed beside her.
There's no need to be upset. It's okay.
He raised a hand as if to wipe a tear, but she turned her head away.
Shush, Kitty. Everything's going to be fine. Your mother and father will be home tomorrow, and you'll get to see your new baby brother. Won't that be great? Tomorrow, everything will be back to normal. Now tell me what's wrong.
She wiped her tears with the back of her hand, and despite her harrowing situation, spoke affirmatively.
I don't ever want you to do that to me again.
Leaning his head back against the wall, he closed his eyes and smiled. Kitty could see the perspiration running down his brow. She could smell the pungent masculine odour of stale sweat emanate from his every pore. Opening his eyes, he struggled to focus on her.
Why are you so upset? There's no harm in it. It's just a game, that's all.
I don't like that game and I never want to play it again, she sobbed.
He lifted his arms and stroked her dark curls clumsily with his fingers.
It's not just a game, Kitty, he said, slurring softly. It's a way of showing people how much you love them.
But Daddy would never play that game with me, she protested.
He smiled, shook his head and ran his fingers through his thick black hair. She noticed his grazed and bloodied knuckles.
Your daddy's far too busy working the farm. Don't get me wrong, he loves you too, just like I do.
Raising his hand, he wiped trickles of sweat from his brow and dried his fingers on his sleeve.
You have to understand that we all have things we have to do that we don't like. I don't like having to plough the fields or muck out the pigsty, but it has to be done. It's for all our benefit. Children don't like going to school, but their parents know best. In later years, they'll be thankful.
But I do like going to school, she blurted.
You're the exception. A very special girl, Kitty. Sometimes by doing things we don't like, for example, cleaning the kitchen floor or washing the clothes, we are really saying thank you.
we are showing others our love and respect. That way we get their love and respect back, and it makes us feel good inside. The cockerel strutted across the yard once more, crowing defiantly. Blackie turned and gave chase. Squawking in terror, wings flapping, feathers flying, it reached the safety of the outhouse roof. The dog barked excitedly, jumping in vain, attempting to reach the bird now defiantly ensconced on a rusted gutter.
"What a crazy dog you have," he said.
Kitty tried to smile.
"Oh, I see you've cut your knee."
"It's nothing," she said.
"Here, let me see."
"Really, it's just a scratch." He lifted the hem of her skirt.
"Yeah, poor thing," he said,
putting his hand around her and kissing her gently on the neck. She could smell potsheen and stale tobacco on his breath and could feel his abrasive stubble rasping against her soft skin. Slowly, he began to lift the hem of her school uniform.
"Trust me, everything's going to be fine."
He inched his hand further up her leg. Petrified, she could feel the coarseness of his palm riding up her thigh. Finally, his fingers touched her knickers, and he tried to ease her legs apart. Kitty recoiled, struggling to break free, but he was much too powerful, and pinned her down, mounting her while she tried to fight him off. In desperation, she bit him in the arm.
"You fucking bitch!"
he roared, slapping her hard across the face with the back of his hand. She could taste the warm blood dripping from her nose. Pulling manically, he ripped the knickers from her and tried to force her legs apart.
"No, stop!" she yelled.
Her desperate cries reverberated around the empty farmyard. Clumsily, he unbuckled his belt.
"No, no," she pleaded.
Fumbling, he undid his flies and lowered his trousers, partly exposing the milky white skin of his muscular thighs. She could feel his hot, excited state press hard against her.
"Stop!" she screamed,
her voice now shrill with terror. He grabbed her tightly by the throat. She kicked and gasped for air.
"Shut up, you stupid bitch, or I swear to God I'll kill you."
Fearing it was no idle threat, she desisted.
"That's the girl. Now there's nothing to be afraid of. Everything's going to be fine. I know you like it. I can tell you're gagging for it."
He released his stranglehold. Kitty coughed, swallowing blood, as she gasped for air. Arching his back, he grabbed his engorged, stiffened flesh and guided it towards the dark triangle and bright pink of her virgin lips.
"Please stop. If Daddy finds out, he'll go mad."
He grasped her bloody face, squeezing her fleshy cheeks so roughly her bottom lips split. Clenching his yellow-stained teeth, he warned her.
"If you breathe a word of this to anybody, do you hear? Anybody, I'll kill you. Do you understand?"
Kitty lay paralysed with fear. With a thrust of his hips, he entered her, rupturing her soft virgin flesh, tearing her like some insatiable beast, frenzied by the scent of bloodied meat. Kitty screamed in pain.
"No, Uncle Bill, you're hurting me."
It is sad to say such scenarios were all too common. Yet, collectively, we, the Irish people, turned a blind eye and uttered not a single word. At least the Germans, who knew of the Holocaust, played stumm for fear of their lives. We, the Irish, feared only what the neighbours might say. In another section of the book, Claire, the protagonist, speaks out in a TV interview after the redress board has agreed to compensation for the victims. The words seem so harrowingly relevant today as they were back then. Let me read them to you. Claire Conlon, how do you feel about the outcome of today's events? "I am suffering mixed emotions. I feel happy that at last the victims will be compensated in some small way. Money was never the issue here. It was about justice, about a country holding up its hand and admitting finally that it had done wrong. A country that tried every trick in the book to suppress and intimidate the victims into silence. A country that tried its living best to break the support groups before they became a threat. A country that tried to cover up its sinister past." How do you feel about the acquittals? "I think it was obvious from the start that there was no hope of putting the guilty behind bars. The church and state are still bedfellows, each looking after their own interests. Whilst I am disappointed with the outcome, I must say I am not in the least bit surprised. Real justice will never be achieved. How many helpless children died under the most suspicious of circumstances while in the care of these institutions? How many innocent souls lie in unmarked graves right across the length and breadth of this country, buried under the cover of darkness by faceless murderers? How many children lie forgotten with neither a death certificate nor a doctor's report in their cold graves? What justice did they get today? I don't think the countless unmarked graves in Letterfrack or Artane or the numerous convents around the country should ever be forgotten. It is up to the good, upstanding citizens of Ireland to make sure we never forget. Their memory should be enshrined in our hearts. We still need answers. We are not just talking about abuse here. We are talking of death and murder at the hands of those in whose care they were entrusted. This country will never fulfil its true potential until it has the courage and backbone to admit to its own Holocaust. We owe the forgotten, at the very least, a memorial. I challenge you politicians out there to stop hiding in the corridors of power and fight for the justice and dignity they deserve. On reading that back, I realise little has changed. We still live in the shadow of one of the darkest moments of our history, and what is sadder still, we the Irish people were complicit. I suppose we could use the excuse of radicalisation by the Catholic Church, brainwashed by a clergy who still believe a newborn child enters this world with original sin on its soul. What, pray tell me, could that sin possibly be? The sin of Adam? Something that happened at the beginning of time. Because of this sin and because some poor innocents died before they were baptised, they were deprived the right to be buried in consecrated ground beside their great-grandparents, their grandparents and their family. How, I wondered, did Jesus manage to avoid such a sin? Oh yeah, the Immaculate Conception. I once worked on a documentary in the 80s in Ireland. We were interviewing a young woman who had given birth to a child outside wedlock 10 years previously. The infant had died before it could be baptised, and when she went to the local priest, he refused her permission to bury the infant in her family grave, saying it could not be buried on consecrated ground. She begged him to allow her to lay her child beside her grandfather, but the priest refused. I remember we drove up the Dublin mountains to see where the mother had been forced to bury her infant. On arriving, we waited as she entered the bogland and searched for a stone that marked the child's grave. We watched her collapse in distress when she realised the stone had been removed and was nowhere to be found, and that she had lost the only link she had with her baby. She cried for almost half an hour, and we tried to comfort and console her. But such was her distress, the interview was abandoned. As I sat in my car driving back down that mountain, all I could think of was that pig-headed priest and the Catholic Church. Had they any semblance of humanity, that innocent little infant would not be left buried in a bog on the side of a mountain. You wouldn't do it to a dog, would you?
Keep listening to TRP.